Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Welcome to the Leaders Toolbox on Firehouse.com. I'm Rich Gassaway, your host. We're coming to you from Fire Rescue International in Dallas, Texas, and I have the privilege and pleasure of having as my guest on the show today Dr. William F. Genoway. Dr. Genoway has over 40 years of experience in the fire service and is employed as the Executive Vice President of VFIS. As the Chief of the King of Prussia Volunteer Fire Company, he was named the Volunteer Fire Chief of the Year by Fire Chief Magazine, its annual conference at the International Association of Fire Chiefs in 2001. King of Prussia is an all-volunteer department and has received accreditation by the Commission on Fire Accreditation International. Among Bill's activities, he has served as the chairman of the Risk Management Standard for the National Fire Protection Association, president of the Congressional Fire Service Institute, sitting on the Underwriter Laboratories Casualty Council, and a member of the Distinguished Gilmore Commission, appointed by the President of the United States, which is studying the readiness of the United States to deal with domestic terrorism involving weapons of mass destruction. In addition, he is the vice chair of the Commission on Fire Accreditation International. An author of more than 100 articles on fire, safety, and management-related topics, Bill has also written 6 texts on fire and safety disciplines and 4 children's books. He's also testified numerous times before local, state, and federal legislative bodies. Bill is an adjunct professor of risk analysis at the Graduate School at St. Joseph University in Philadelphia and the California University of Pennsylvania. Bill was the project leader for the development of the United States Fire Administration's publication, Emergency Vehicle Safety Operations for Volunteer and Small Combination Fire Departments. It's a great pleasure to invite you to be here with me today, Bill.
Thanks, Rich. It's a pleasure to be here.
And today we are going to take up the topic of emergency vehicle safety. It is a topic that Bill has spoken about at numerous conferences around the country. And I had seen this on the agenda at a conference, and it piqued my interest, and I thought it would be great if I could get you on as a guest to share with our listeners some important information about emergency vehicle safety. As I say, you've conducted this session, arriving safe at the scene and the station numerous times. Can you elaborate for the listeners upon what's the idea behind the class and its content, and why should we be concerned about vehicle operations in the emergency services?
Well, Rich, I think by this time everyone has seen the data from the Fallen Firefighters Foundation, which states 25% of our firefighter fatalities are really resulting from vehicle accidents in some way, shape, or form. So if we start out in a traditional safety concept, you have that small number of critical events that really are the most tragic events, that's 25 fatalities. Then if you begin to look at the pyramid approach, you're going to have X number of incidents that occur where they were not fatal but may have had serious long-term disability incidents. You then take the next group, which there may have been a series of accidents, and you had some lesser short-term disability. Then you get to the next level, which is going to be the number of accidents that occur where there is actually some type of damage, but maybe no physical injury. And then, of course, there's the incident where there's no damage, but you had the incident. Suddenly, we're not talking about 25 incidents. Now we're talking about thousands. And in fact, the National Safety Council estimates there's somewhere between 17 and 20,000 emergency vehicle accidents each year. Let's put a cost factor to that. Let's put a human factor to that. And suddenly we're talking about billions of dollars of impact. We're talking about tons of time that people aren't able to be on the job, whether it's volunteer or career. We're talking, if it's a career operation, about a ton of overtime now where people have to fill in. So there is a cost factor involved, there is a human factor involved, and if you have that serious accident, there's a vehicle replacement factor involved. So if you're going to lose a vehicle for 6 months for repair, or if it's totaled, how do you get that new truck? Do you get a loaner? Do you get a vehicle right off the line? What's the method of purchase and so on? And if you can't buy it because you haven't reserved funds, you have a whole nother set of adverse situations. So while people may think that a vehicle accident where you just ding the fender or you back into the building is really an insignificant issue, really isn't.
And there's also the factor of the consequence to the families of those firefighters who would be hurt or killed as well.
Absolutely, and this is probably an awful thing to say, but a long-term disability injury to a firefighter in many cases is much more devastating over the long term than the death of a firefighter. So we really have to take a hard look at this whole picture of vehicle safety. And if we look at industrial safety concepts, we can see a very significant relationship to the fire services applying safety concepts that were used in business and industry back in the 30s, and we're just getting to them today.
Well, the fire service in many ways seems to lag behind some of the best practices in industry. But it's nice to see that we're maybe starting to catch up to some of the lessons that they have learned. While on the topic of the best practices, I know in your classes you talk about the best practices for emergency vehicle safety. Can you elaborate on that some?
Sure. In fact, when we conducted the research for the USFA project that you mentioned in my introduction, we identified 10 best practice areas that can be implemented. And if you look at this big picture, and in the document there is a graphic that explains it extremely well, but if you look at it, this is no different than a corporate fleet management program. So if I were driving box trucks, if I were driving tractor trailers, if I were driving service delivery trucks, the concepts that we're applying here were all the same. It starts off with very fundamentally personal responsibility. And I think that if we were to look at everything we do in the fire service, there's a level of personal responsibility and decision-making and judgment that probably hasn't been executed in the interest of safety over the years. I can remember back in the 70s going through smoke divers class where people threw chairs at you and people threw soda, or yeah, in Western Pennsylvania we called them pop cases. And the objective was to go through a very hostile environment. Today, that's not the way we train our firefighters. And we train them today for a different set of expectations. And frankly, if you're in that hostile situation, where's the value? Mm-hmm. We didn't realize that back in the 70s. Today, we do. So personal responsibility, meaning there has to be a champion of this process. Someone has to have authority and responsibility and accountability to make it happen, is the number one key. Once you move from personal responsibility, then you have to make sure that you put the right person in the driver's seat, you put the right person in the officer's seat of a vehicle. And if you get the right person driving and you get the right person as the officer, suddenly the whole environment is going to change, because they are going to think personal responsibility, vehicle safety, getting my people to the scene, making sure that they are going to arrive safely at the scene and get back to the station safely. So putting those officers in place and having officers that can train you in your standard operating guidelines, train you in this personal accountability issue, train you in basic emergency vehicle operations, train you in refresher training whenever that's necessary. If there is some vehicle design characteristic that is important, then they should be training you in that. Every time a new vehicle comes in, there should be training in that. And if I can digress for just a second, we just purchased a series of new vehicles over the past few years. And as each new vehicle came in, I challenged the delivery engineer, with the features of this vehicle that were different than the features of the vehicle it was replacing, so that we could talk to our drivers about the difference of the height, the weight, the center of gravity, the steerability of the vehicle, the braking distance, and so on, so that the drivers understood the difference between that nice, sleek little vehicle that they were getting rid of and this new, bigger, longer, higher, wider, heavier, faster vehicle. So that's the second component, training. The third item comes when you do have an accident that, or an incident, that it's investigated properly. And whether it's a near miss, a near hit, or an actual accident, recording the information and on a periodic basis reviewing it, which would be point number four, which would be a loss analysis. Making sure that over the course of the year or 2 years or 3 years if you're a small department, look at all your accidents, figure out what's causing them, and address those issues that are causing them. So if you're the bad driver, Rich, and you're the one that's having the repeat accidents, we're going to come get you. And we're going to find out if it's a driver training issue, we're going to find out if it's an ability for you to deal with that vehicle, or if there's something else at hand. The fourth item is really that, managing driving behavior. And one of the other things that can be done on a regular basis is a simple motor vehicle record check of all drivers. It's amazing how many drivers will have an accident with their personal vehicle, get caught speeding, have other traffic violations, and never tell the fire officer. And that will tell you a lot about that person's personal responsibility viewpoint. Then comes the whole issue of enforcement of SOGs, the monitoring of the driver's performance. And I always suggest, don't just reprimand drivers, reward them. If they go a whole year or a period of time or a certain amount of miles without an accident, give them something. I know in private industry we did this for several big fleet operations, and it was amazing what that little token of thanks meant to that driver, that he or she was recognized for being safe. And once you deal with the driving behavior, then we also have to look at regulatory compliance. And we can't avoid those regulatory issues. The next item would be timely reporting of incidents, making sure that when they occur, you don't wait 6 months to file the report. And then comes the whole concept of loss prevention techniques. And these best practices, individual best practices, things like reduced response activity. It may be reducing the number of vehicles, it may be on the silent response, could even be traffic preemption. Knock on wood, we instituted traffic preemption about 9 years ago in my community, and we haven't had an intersection accident since.
Nice.
There has to be some value in that. Yes, there's a cost associated, but let's look at impact fees to make people pay for those traffic control devices, and then look at the ability to move an ambulance to an intersection or a fire truck to an intersection, and there's great benefit from that. Of course, alcohol and drug policy and related enforcement. We have the use of visual monitoring devices now, and of course these are devices that monitor you going forward and or in reverse. These are exceptional techniques to review driver behavior, especially if there's been an accident. Now the downside is, if you've done something and you're at fault, you're caught. If you've not done something and the video can document that, all of a sudden you're the good guy here and you can pursue either that adverse situation that someone's filing a claim against you or making an accusation against you and get rid of that problem very, very quickly. There are also the use of warning devices and the limitations of warning devices that become a good loss control technique. Of course, driver selection, vehicle inspection techniques, routine maintenance. It's amazing, as we go around the country and we talk to departments, many departments still use the as-needed inspection and as-needed maintenance program, and that just doesn't work on today's vehicles. Today's newer vehicles have to be maintained to those warranty schedules because that's the way the engine was designed. That's the way the building or the vehicle components were designed. And the last item goes to reflective striping. For years it was fought, we don't want to put this reflective striping on our vehicles, but boy, it sure makes a difference in the visibility of those units. So those are a series of loss prevention techniques, and I'm sure there are others, but the component there is the critical factor. The last two somewhat go together. One deals with apparatus design and construction, which when you're designing a vehicle, you need to hold that manufacturer somewhat accountable with you, in saying, look, if I'm doing something stupid on this truck, you've got to tell me. If I'm building a vehicle that's too big, too heavy, too fast, You, as the manufacturer, need to tell me that. We may come to a point of disagreement and still buy it. However, you need to make us aware of the problem and not just give us the vehicle and then tell us after the fact that it's a problem. The other issue deals with hot topics, and this has been a hot topic over the years with some of the new vehicle designs. But the hot topics now, of course, are accidents that are happening in your area with other emergency vehicle operators, highway safety issues, personal vehicles, rollovers, intersection safety, and seatbelts. And maybe we should do just one question, Rich, on just seatbelts.
I'll make a note of it. We'll come back to it. You had mentioned a couple of times in that answer, Bill, on the best practices about making sure that you have the right people as the driver or operator of the apparatus. In some departments, everyone is expected to be an apparatus operator. Would you say that's a good practice or a bad practice, or indifferent to it as long as they do certain things?
Well, I don't think there's a problem in having as many apparatus operators as is possible. However, I'll go back to my industrial safety experience again. And in that review of data over the years, and I mean literally tons of accident reports that you look at with clients, there are some phenomena that come out about people. One of the things is this concept of accident repeaters, and all of our departments have somebody who is constantly being treated for an accident at a scene. there are two theories behind that. One is that accident repeaters are just, they're prevalent to accidents. The other one, which I subscribe to, is that a person is either mentally incapable of doing that particular job, or they are physically incapable of doing that job, or they are not being supervised properly. They are physically and mentally able, but they're not being supervised properly. So putting that into context, it's important to look at your drivers. And if somebody is constantly backing into things, there's a problem. If somebody has 3, 4, 5 accidents a year, there's a problem, and let's get under that. And if they're retrainable, that's one scenario. If you retrain them and they continue to do it, then you have something else at hand. And I know people like this. I've seen them. The best thing for them is to get them off that line. So while the objective of having as many people possible that can drive the vehicle is a great goal, particularly in your smaller departments, and I guess even in the bigger departments, if you can rotate people through those positions, I have no conceptual problem with it. But watch out for those accident repeaters, because they should not be doing that. And for some of them, frankly, maybe we find padded rooms for them somewhere. Keep them in those rooms so they don't hurt themselves.
Coming back when you gave the list of the 10 best practices, I want to just make sure, if I understand this right, vehicle safety isn't just dependent on one specific initiative. Am I getting that right? Yeah, we'll edit him out, and I'll ask the question again.
Okay.
Bill, coming back to the 10 best practices, if I understand it right, of what you were saying, the vehicle safety isn't just dependent on one specific initiative. Am I understanding that correctly?
That's correct. It isn't dependent upon one initiative. In fact, a few years back, we tried a focused program at VFIS. We saw trends in vehicle accidents going in a certain direction, and we initiated a program called Operation Safe Arrival. And that focused in on really 4 critical areas, which we subsequently developed individual training programs, 1 hour each on, because they were the areas identified as the most frequent and ultimately most severe types of vehicle incidents. The first one of those was intersection accidents. And it was amazing how many people where there was a negative right-of-way ended up involved in an accident. And then you have to look at a variety of factors. Was there a state law that gives them some ability to move through that negative right-of-way justifiably and under law? And if so, where did the problem occur? Did someone not allow them passage? Did someone ignore that and hit them? Did they hit someone else? And the intersection accident really boils down to the basic premise of, regardless of whether or not you have the right of way, there has to be clear passage. So making sure that you're moving through that intersection, if you have the green light or not, making sure there's clear passage, looking in all directions, having that officer help the driver look in all directions, slow the vehicle to a speed that's going to get you through that intersection in a safe fashion. I can remember many, many times in my early years where it didn't matter to me, I was going through that intersection. I've learned over the years that's not the right way to do it. Too many things become at risk. So you have to be making sure that there's clear passage. So intersection was number one.
Let me pause for a second, Bill, and we'll get on to number two. You said negative right of way. That might be a term that's maybe unfamiliar to some of the listeners. So, you know, what's a negative right of way?
Well, a negative right of way would be that you have a scenario where you have a stop sign, so you don't have the right of way, but you have the authority to move through that intersection. That authority is given to you by virtue of a state law, maybe even a local or city ordinance, or it may be by courtesy that people stop for you and allow you passage. So there is a right of way implied because you are an emergency vehicle. There is a negative scenario to it because you don't theoretically have that right of way.
Okay, thanks.
I hope I explained that properly.
Yeah, no, thanks for explaining that. I appreciate that.
The second point that you asked about, I think, is centered around rollover safety or rollover prevention. And here, again, we were under the impression, I think, from data from NIOSH, that most of these accidents involving rollovers were tankers. On the surface, if you look at the NIOSH reports for fatalities, that would be the case. However, when we started looking at the data from our own internal information, we saw it wasn't just rollovers. We had more ambulances rolling over than we did tankers. We had pumpers rolling over. We had aerial devices rolling over. So we had SUVs rolling over. So it's not a characteristic that's just dealing with tankers. The bottom line factor here is when that vehicle is driving down the road and you drop that front right wheel off the macadam onto the berm, whether it's a soft shoulder or not, when you try to bring it back up onto the highway, if you come up at too high of a speed or too sharp of an angle, the probability of the rollover or at least some kind of uncontrollable steering situation is highly probable. And as a result, you have to make sure that you're driving that vehicle safe. And we're finding that because of the nature of the tankers, just the building design, that people are more seriously injured because of the way the vehicle rolls over and the amount of force that's in the tanker, just because of the amount of water that's in there. So rollovers would be number two. Number three is basically the personal auto issue. And here we throw SUVs into that because many people are being injured as they are simply moving down a highway at too fast of a speed. And it's interesting, Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and State Farm Insurance went together on a study last year. And in that study, they identified the primary reasons that teenagers are killed in traffic accidents. And it was amazing that seatbelt issues, driver distraction issues, and unfamiliarity of the vehicle were the three prime reasons for vehicle fatalities involving teens. If we look at an emergency vehicle, we are looking at firefighter fatalities for the same basic reasons. They aren't wearing seatbelts, there are significant distractions, and the unfamiliarity of the vehicle. So maybe, it's a harsh statement, but maybe firefighters driving vehicles that are involved in accidents are using the same driving patterns and techniques that we used as teenagers.
Interesting perspective. I probably some would out there say, "How dare you compare me to a teenage driver?" But when you look at the data of what's the contributing factors, and they align, so you know it's indisputable.
And in fact, that has happened. I wrote an article on this in VFIS News, and I immediately had a respondent that said, "How dare you relate me to a teenager?" And I replied back, and I said, "Well, Obviously, you're not one of the ones we're talking right. about, but there has to be a pool of people that has that same driving behavior if the characteristics are the same.
Right, exactly. This is the Leader's Toolbox on Firehouse.com. I'm your host, Rich Gassaway, and we are at Fire Rescue International in Dallas, Texas, with Dr. Bill Genoway talking on the topic of emergency vehicle safety. We'll be back in just a moment to continue this discussion on this very important topic for the fire service.
Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Welcome back to the Leader's Toolbox on Firehouse.com. I'm your host, Rich Gassaway, and I'm with Dr. Bill Genoway at Fire Rescue International in Dallas, Texas, and we're talking about the important topic of emergency vehicle safety. Bill, for those fire departments looking to develop a simplistic approach to kick off a driving safety program or to evaluate what they have in place, can you provide some suggestions?
Well, I think that I would characterize it as the STSS approach.
Oh, we have an acronym.
We have a little acronym here, yeah. The first one would be to select the right people. If, as we talked about earlier, if you put a person in the driver's seat that isn't going to be focused on driving or has some issue with their ability to drive these vehicles, you're going to have a problem. So selection becomes the number one feature. The second point, the T, becomes the training. If we don't train them, if we don't retrain them, if we don't specifically train them on that vehicle that they're driving, and if we don't train them whenever we get new vehicles, then we aren't going to be able to perform adequately whenever we're needed. The third one is the second S is supervise. You have to supervise, and then that goes along with the fourth S, which is the SOGs. So we bring a person in, we make sure they're the right person, we train them, we make sure that the standard operating guidelines are embedded in their mind when they're driving these vehicles, and then the supervisor monitors to make sure that they're driving it the way they're trained, they're performing it the way that they're supposed to perform by the standard operating guidelines, and if there's any deviation, they take action and they make this driver do things the right way. And, you know, I mean, let's face it, there is an adrenaline rush. Nobody's going to deny that when you're driving down the road. But that adrenaline rush has to be managed. And it's the same if you're going to be a football player and you're running down to catch that pass and your adrenaline's pumped up because you know it's coming to you. You slow down to catch it. You speed up to catch it. You turn to catch it. But you adjust. And that's what drivers have to learn. There isn't just one way, which is just to go out, move the vehicle and get there fast. You have to be able to get there safely.
Sure. Now, you in that acronym, Bill, you mentioned two things that I want to just briefly follow up on. One was training, and the other one was SOPs or SOGs. Is there any good model training programs out there or model or sample SOPs or SOGs that if somebody were looking to say develop their training program from start that they could use as a model?
Well, I'll start by patting VFIS on the back. As you well know, back in the 70s, VFIS first initiative into the field was to develop a driver safety program, which is now adopted as either the program or one of the accepted programs in 32 states in the United States. It was also adopted by the National Fire Academy, and it's one of the programs that's mentioned as part of their acceptable methods of training drivers. So, of course, that would be one. But I think that what we need to do is also understand that there are a variety of training methodologies available. And what we have to understand is that each state in their fire academies or their equivalent really looks at this issue and identifies what they believe to be the right things for their area. So I would suggest that an organization looking to start a program go to their state fire academy, take a look there, and if they can't get something there, then by all means give VFIS a call, and you know, our program is available to clients for free and non-clients for a small fee. So that's definitely an option. With regard to other options, when the USFA program for volunteer and small combination programs was being developed. There was a parallel program being developed through the IAFF for large combination departments and career departments. We then sat down with the IAFC and merged the two programs at the highest level and came out with an IAFC overall approach that would deal with the management of vehicle incidents and vehicle safety. So looking at this program that we've been referencing here today, looking at the IAFF program and looking at the IAFC program gives you the broadest approach to developing fleet safety programs that you could possibly have. And I really don't think you need to go beyond those three other than to do a specific training for your department.
Mm-hmm. What about model SOPs? Are those included in that program?
They are included in that program. In fact, if you contact the National Volunteer Fire Council as well, they have the program available on a CD, and they can send that out to you. Or you can go to the websites for the various organizations, and they're available as downloads. In fact, one of the things that we did in the development of the program for the volunteer and small combination departments was research out about 25 different SOGs, and we created samples that are actually in the manual, and they also are driven by what we've learned at VFIS over the years. And I would also say that VFIS has them available on our website. You can download specific items that may actually not even be in that 25, but are things that we've found that are key factors. And yeah, I'd be remiss if I didn't tell you at this point, what we find as the number one frequent issue across all claims is actually backing into things. So that spotter policy, whether you want to believe it, spotters are critical. Yes, backup cameras help, but the spotter is the key to this. And it's amazing how many doors we buy. It's amazing. And I'm talking about doors on fire trucks as well as fire station doors or ambulance squad doors. It's just amazing. How many of those we pay for every year. And a spotter would definitely help.
I've talked to a number of chiefs who have heard express frustrations about their apparatus being backed into things. And you know that people aren't out there doing it on purpose, trying to create issues for themselves or issues for their department or to damage the vehicles, but nonetheless it's happening. I'll put some links on the bottom of the player page to VFIS and the National Volunteer Fire Council, the NVFC, and the International Association of Fire Chiefs, IFC, that Bill had mentioned as resources for training and SOGs. Bill, I want to back up for a moment because you said the possibility of just taking on seat belts as a separate question. So I'm not really going to put it out there in the form of a question, but I'm just going to open it up and give you a chance to say what you think would be the most important messages about seat belt safety.
Well, I think there's just a one-liner about seat belts, and that's wear them. Don't move the truck unless everybody's belted. And that takes a lot of emphasis on the part of the driver and the supervisor. But if you adopt a protocol that said, look, we're not moving this truck until everybody's seated and belted. And you know, I would challenge people that if you believe that that's the wrong thing to do, tell me why. Because I've not seen, with very, very few exceptions, and they would be known cases, where moving a vehicle without being belted and seated is more of a priority than getting the people there safely to be able to do the job. And I'm not suggesting that you wait for people if there's a life-threatening situation with known entrapment. I'm not suggesting that. But what I'm suggesting is if you're going out for a standard automatic fire alarm and people are just getting in the truck and getting their gear on and then standing up and moving the truck, that's not necessarily the safest thing to do. So let's take a hard look at this. And I can tell you from experience that because this is my approach, if I get in the vehicle in the officer's seat or in the driver's seat, and that vehicle is ready to, you know, the guys are in the back ready to go, if they aren't belted, truck doesn't move.
I had, about a year ago, had the opportunity to ride along with a metropolitan-sized fire department, and I was in the jump seat of a vehicle that seated five people in the back, and I was one of the five, and then there was the officer and an operator in the front. And when I got in, I was looking for the seatbelt, which was buried back so far behind the SCBA that it was obvious to me that it wasn't something that was commonly worn. And as I was digging a root, and I really wasn't looking around and paying attention to what the other people were doing, but when I finally grabbed the seatbelt and I brought it and I put around me and clicked it in, the other four back in the jump seat were almost looking at me like I was from outer space because I put the seatbelt on. And then from the front seat, the officer said, "Everybody got their seatbelts on," and the entire crew said, "Yeah, we're good," and not one of them was wearing their seatbelt. So it was like the officer was going through the obligatory, the policy says I'm supposed to ask everybody if they have their seatbelt on before the truck turns. I asked them, they said they did, and wheels turned, and it wasn't until a call. We were going to a training, so we weren't in emergency mode. But the officer asked, the firefighter said yes, and the truck rolled, and no one had their seatbelt on. I didn't turn around to look to the front seat to see if the officer and the operator had theirs on. I was facing backwards. But I thought what I was seeing is just symptomatic of a cultural problem that we're having.
You're absolutely right. And, I think back to a couple of other issues related to seatbelts. And our colleague, Dr. Bert Clark, has for years decided that and advocated this whole issue of people signing a pledge to buckle up. And I know our department, we passed it around at a meeting and got everybody to sign it, that was the thing we were going to do because it was the right thing to do. But you're very well taken with your point there. I remember my first car. And if you didn't have the seatbelt buckled, this annoying buzzer went off. So what did I do? I had bucket seats in a car. I buckled it under the seat, so I never had to worry about it. And yes, it was always buckled. but that clearly isn't the way we need to do things today, and we need to find alternative ways. Another point about seatbelts is I hear this excuse all the time that, well, we can't buy extenders, and the manufacturer won't warranty the vehicle belt if we retrofit the belt. Well, if you're not wearing the belt today, what use is it? So let's be realistic here. Retrofit the belt because you're going to have an accident at some point in time, and let's at least be somewhat prepared by having a belt that fits somebody, even if there is no liability for the belt on the apparatus manufacturer. Everything else is still going to be warranted.
Yep. Agreed. Billy Goldfeder's The Secret List, he often highlights the vehicle accidents that occur around the country, and when he somewhere in the paragraph is usually what injuries resulted and then whether the occupants were belted or unbelted. And inevitably it seems as though when he says and only minor injuries occurred, it ends with and all the firefighters were belted, or firefighters were ejected from the vehicle and critical injuries and airlifted and they weren't belted. And I wonder how many times we have to keep drilling that message into the fire service before people are going to connect the dots and see the belts mean less severity of injuries.
Absolutely.
Bill, I'm sure that in your fire department at King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, an accredited department with the Commission on Fire Accreditation International and a department you've led for many years, that they've implemented a couple of different programs that might be worthwhile for sharing with our listeners. So what might they be?
Well, I mentioned earlier the emitter system to allow us assured green light passage through intersections. And just observation both of watching police, EMS, and fire vehicles move through there, as well as having the opportunity to drive vehicles through that, this helps. There is no question that giving you control of an intersection reduces the opportunity. It doesn't mean that you fly through the intersection. It means that it will stop and allow you that clear passage. And many people that I've talked to over the years say, well, it's too costly. We can't afford it. In our community, we implemented it as an impact fee. So if a developer wanted to build a development and it required a red light to be put there or a stoplight to be put there, they had to pay for the emitter. We got a grant for it from the Department of Transportation. I'm sure anybody can apply for that same type of grant. So over the years, we've minimized the impact of that cost on the municipality by finding alternative ways to fund this. Then the only cost came in the infrastructure of the vehicles, which was really a minimal cost when you compare it to all the other things you put on a fire truck or an ambulance or a police car. So that was one aspect. The second thing, and I'll flip back here to the seatbelts, you know, and I mentioned that we have a policy for the seatbelts. We implemented the sign-off that, you know, we agree that this is the right thing to do. But of course, you have people that aren't going to do it. So how do you manage that? And our chief engineer said, why don't we put buzzers in the trucks? So we have buzzers in the trucks for two things, for seatbelts and for speed. So if the vehicle is going over 45 miles an hour, the buzzer goes off. And you know as well as I do, an annoying buzzer constantly is not going to be what you want. So drivers immediately back off on that 45 miles an hour speed limit. And let's face it, unless we're on one of the interstates going to an accident, we're not going to be driving those trucks that fast anyway. You just can't do it in traffic. The other thing is with the seatbelts. And it's amazing how fast people put those seatbelts on because they don't want that buzzer to happen. The other thing is that we have over the years been developing a comprehensive SOGs on just about everything that we think we should be doing. And there aren't really things that we hammer people on, but they're used as training devices for people so that whenever you come into the organization, you know what the expectation is. And then if someone violates it, there's no immediate policy of suspension or something like that. But it's, hey, do you remember about this? And we go over SOGs on a regular basis. Every company meeting once a month, the safety officer is given an opportunity to discuss anything she wants to, and many times it's about operations of the vehicles. So I think the policies and procedures, those devices that we've installed, and just recognition of the fact that there's personal responsibility here has helped us over the years with this. And our accident frequency, we still have accidents. You're not going to get away from them, but I think that the extent of damage is less than what I can recall from 15, 20, 25 years ago.
Good. It sounds like it's working. So it might be a model that others might want to try to emulate with some of the things that you're doing at King of Prussia. Bill, you work for VFIS, and I can't hardly bring this program to a close without giving you an opportunity to at least share with our listeners some of the extensive array of training and support materials that are available to them through the VFIS. So what are some of the things that you might recommend to the listeners?
Well, thanks for the opportunity to chat about this for a minute, Rich. First of all, as I mentioned earlier, our driver training program dates back to the 70s in the first edition, and it was done by firefighters back then. And still today, in our most recent revision of last year, it was created, tested, and implemented by firefighters. So we know what causes accidents. Our program is designed to prevent those accidents through education, and it's designed to do it in an educational format coupled with the actual practical hands-on format. So that program I recommend to everybody. It is fundamental. It's a 16-hour program, and it's adopted in some form in 32 states. We also have supplemental training programs that go with this. And they are designed to be anywhere from 1 to 4 hours, depending upon what the department wants it to be. And they include intersections, rollover, highway safety, POVs. And then we have a specific one which just reinforces the principles of that basic class, which we call vehicle dynamics or emergency vehicle response. And those are separate programs of about 2 to 4 hours. And these all can be used on a refresher training basis or on an initial training basis. We have a total of 60 different programs that we offer, the majority of which deal with vehicle safety. We also have a whole series of forms which you can use as the individual departments. They are all downloadable for free on our website. The forms are. The forms have everything from maintenance issues related to those to inventory items and so on. And then we also have the opportunity to provide these SOGs and some critical information in the form of communiques. And those also can be downloaded for free from our website at www.vfis.com. This past year, we have implemented a new program. We're in the distance learning business. If you're a client, you actually can log on to our site and get the programs for free. There's a charge for non-clients. This is all designed in the interest of risk management and hoping that we can manage the actual loss experience of our clients. The website we are doing in conjunction with St. Joseph's University, and the programs right now, we have three up and running, and three more will be up by the end of the year, and three more will be available in the first quarter of next year. So we'll have nine programs up. They aren't all vehicle related, but the objective here is to transform some of our traditional classroom training into the distance learning environment, number one. The second aspect is to take certain things that you need to do on an annual refresher basis and actually be able to do those online, do the sign-off, document it, record it, file it, etc., so that those annual things, like in some states, sexual harassment training is required, BBP is required. So we're setting up programs that you can actually do that and record it and not have to bring people in for training sessions. The third thing is that we have a couple of textbooks we've written over the years, and our objective long-term is to transform day one of our driver training into distance learning so that it requires less time on site for people, and then also to take our textbooks and actually get college credit for those textbooks if you complete a course related to those management programs. That's a little longer term, but that's the vision that we have for our distance learning operation.
Well, I don't know of any other insurance company that has been as aggressive as VFIS in trying to ensure firefighter safety and improve fire safety practices within fire departments. You talk about, you got classroom classes, online classes, developing classes for college credit, books that you've written, free downloads on your website. The VFIS has been very visionary in realizing and contributing to trying to reduce injuries and accidents for the fire service. And I know there are many of us out there that appreciate the effort of your company to do that, and it certainly is making a difference.
Well, thanks, Richard. And just to close that portion out, our founder, Art Gladfelter, had a vision when he started the business back in the late 50s, early 60s, and that was really to make sure that when people had a problem, that they could find some solution to that problem. And he started it out with insurance products for the fire service, and then had the vision to see that, you know, we ought to be going into something else. And if vehicle accidents was the key, let's do vehicle accidents. If it was firefighter safety, and I remember before I even went to work at VFIS, I worked at the Cigna companies and handled the safety programs for them. We actually did one of those first safety programs called Loss Control for Fire Departments back as far as 1980. So this has been a long-term initiative for us, and we're seeing results on it.
Good. This is Rich Gassaway, the host of the Leaders Toolbox at Firehouse.com. I'm with Dr. Bill Genoway, and we're at Fire Rescue International in Dallas, Texas. Bill, I want to thank you for the gift of your time. I know you're busy here at the conference with many meetings and obligations that you have with your involvement with the International Association of Fire Chiefs, and for you to be able to give me an hour to sit down and talk about this topic is certainly a gift to the fire service and one that I appreciate, and thank you for being my guest today.
My pleasure, Rich. Thank you.
Okay.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening. And stay tuned to Firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.